The Theosophical Society presents Mr. Boris de Zirkov in a talk entitled The Life of HPB.
The following interview on the life of Madame Blavatsky was made at Alcott during the 1958 summer sessions. Mr. Boris de Zirkov of Los Angeles was questioned by Mr. Ralph Gardner of the Denver Lodge. Mr. de Zirkov, who is a grand-nephew of Madame Blavatsky, was reared and educated at the Point Loma Theosophical Society, but he is not now affiliated with any theosophical group. He is perhaps best known as the editor and compiler of the collected writings of H.P. Blavatsky, and he is in addition the editor of a small journal, Theosophia, which is sponsored by an international group of theosophists and whose objectives are, in Mr. de Zirkov's words, to uphold and promote the original principles of the modern theosophical movement, and to disseminate the teachings of the esoteric philosophy as set forth by H.P. Blavatsky and her teachers.
This is an interview with Mr. Boris de Zirkov of Los Angeles, who has been a lifelong student of the life and writings of Madame H.P. Blavatsky, the principal founder of the Theosophical Society. Mr. de Zirkov, could you give us a brief statement of the family background of Madame Blavatsky? I understand that she was related to fairly high circles of the Russian nobility.
Yes, Mr. Gardner. HPV belonged to a very old Russian family on the side of her grandmother, who was Princess Dolgorukova, and on the other side, the side of her father, she belonged to a German family that had immigrated into Russia about 300 years ago, more or less, and became really a Russian family, the von Hahns. The various members of the family of the Princess Dolgorukov belonged to the nobility of old Russia, and from their ranks have arisen quite a number of very well-known individuals in the history of Russia. Also, one or two of them, members of that old family, became empresses of Russia in the olden days. Now, the German family von Hahn, they came in about 200 years before HPB's days, probably under Catherine the Great, more or less. We do not know the exact beginnings of that family in Russia. But originally they came from Mecklenburg in Germany. HPB's background, family background, was quite renowned in many ways because so many people in her family were well-known people in Russian history. HPB herself, of course, always said that this background was not too important, as the thing that we have to pay attention to is the character of the individual and not exactly their lineage. But to some extent, even the physical lineage has an importance of its own, and the hereditary traits of these families were well reflected in HPB's own character.
Mr. de Zirkov, what do you know about the birth and early prospects of Madame Blavatsky's life? Well, was there anything foretold in her childhood as to her possible future greatness?
H.P. Blavatsky was born in the night between the 30th and the 31st of July, according to the old calendar, the old style, so-called, the calendar that was prevalent in Russia in those days. And that was in 1831. Now, this seemed to be a popular tradition in the folklore of the country that children born in that particular night are going to control the elemental forces of nature. And apparently this was quite a correct prophecy in the case of HPB. HPB had, I don't know what to say, a fortunate or unfortunate destiny or fate to be kind of thrown around and about during her early years, because the father belonged to the horse artillery in Russia, and the regiment was moving from one town to another, and there was very little supervision of the children and the family, and the mother was very sickly. So there were some hard years there. HPB's mother was a very remarkable individual, one of the first women in Russia who fought for women's rights. She was an outstanding writer. She wrote novels, which in those days were considered first-class novels. And she was, as I said, a sickly person who died very young. And there was quite a bit of incompatibility between her and her husband, Colonel Peter von Hahn, HPB's father. Anyway, very soon HPB was transferred into the family of her grandparents. And from then on, things were a little easier. Now, it must be remembered that HPB was a very unusual sort of a child. She was greatly mediumistic. All sorts of strange happenings took place around her. And for a good many years, she had these mediumistic and psychic powers under no control whatever. We have strong and conclusive evidence on the part of several people, including her own sister Vera, to the effect that this was by no means just the imagination of anybody, but actual facts concerning HPB's early life. HPB was a very strong-willed individual right from the very beginning, and her marriage at such an early age, that was in 1849, which means that she was hardly 18, was a strange event in her life. She was not an individual fitted for any kind of a married life anyway, and though we do not know the exact reasons for that marriage, but it would appear that HPB, who was already then really a disciple and a very unusually awakened individual, was trying to get away from the family background, and it is very likely that she chose this manner, this way of acting, to get away from everything that was around her, which she actually did, because after marrying an elderly gentleman, Nikifor Blavatsky, who, by the way, was not a general, as has been stated in many books. He was a civil employee in the government of the Caucasus. After marrying him, she ran away from him. And that was the end of all this Russian background. She took a steamer and went to Constantinople. And that was the beginning of her many and very unusual travels the world over.
Where did she get money to travel after she got to Constantinople, and what did she do for the next few years?
As far as we know from her own statements and the statements of her relatives, the money for her travels came from her father. There was a very close relationship between her and her father. He always knew where she was and sent her money. HPB traveled the better part of 10 years. She went twice to the United States in those early days, anywhere between 1850 in 1858, more or less. She crossed the United States twice in covered wagons. There is evidence that she stayed somewhere in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and other places, as well as Florida. She investigated the Indians in Canada. She must have gone to all sorts of other places of which we have no record. It is very likely that she was in Yucatan, as well as in Honduras and in Peru, investigating various secret centers of the Brotherhood of Adepts. This, of course, I could not very well prove, but the chances are very great that she was visiting here and there various mystical centers of which the world knows but little, in preparation, as it were, for her work. We find some evidences about it here and there, but it is very difficult to find a connected story, to write or say something that would be completely coherent about these 10 years of travel. It is also during these 10 years that she tried to get into Tibet and failed. She made at least 2 attempts, but they were unsuccessful.
In what years?
That must have been approximately in 1856 and possibly 57. She returned to Russia in 1858.
Do you think she was in the United States at any time during the Civil War period?
I hardly think so. I believe during that time she was somewhere in the Orient, as far as the dates go. As far as we know by the very scarce dates at our disposal.
What was the impact on her family on her return to Russia?
The impact on her family was quite considerable, because she was still in possession of a great many psychic powers, only partially under control. She was considered to be a very strong medium when she was in Russia, although a very close observation would reveal that some of these powers were under her control, as they are not in the case of ordinary mediums. Now, it is after her return to Russia in 1858, and before she left Russia again and for good in 1863, more or less, it is during these 4 to 5 years that she went through some great change, inward change, very likely around 1863 or 62, and probably while in the Caucasus. A change which brought into complete control her own psychological nature. So we might speak of that change as one of her initiatory trials and tribulations and successes, so that the evidence would show, the existing evidence, that she left Russia around 1864 an entirely different person, in that she ceased to be the strongly psychic temperament that she was before, and could be looked upon as a practical occultist. There's a great deal about it that is contained in Sinet's Incidents in the Life of Madame Blavatsky.
Whereabouts was she living in the Caucasus during that period?
She was mainly in Tiflis, but also in the back country. She tried her hand at various commercial enterprises, curiously enough. She was engaged in at least one business that we have some record of, and that is, she was shipping or having made some arrangement for shipping cork out of the mountains in the Caucasus towards one of the harbors on the Black Sea. She engaged in several enterprises like this. Whether they were a sort of a cover-up for her occult activities is difficult to say, but they might have been just that.
While HPB was at home during this period of a few years, did she demonstrate any psychic faculties or occult powers to members of her family that convinced them of the reality of the unseen world?
Yes, very definitely so. There is quite a good deal of material in the journal, daily journal of her sister Vera, concerning this. An enormous amount of psychological phenomena took place in the family and among friends during her residence in Russia after her return from abroad. And these various phenomena created quite a stir among the people. There was no complete explanation of them. Many members of the family and friends were spiritualists in those days, and of course interpreted these phenomena in a totally different way from which real occultists would. But the record exists, and it is perfectly plain that the return of HPB in the midst of her family and among her friends created quite a stir and was well remembered.
Has the diary or the journal of the sister Vera ever been published intact as written?
Not altogether intact, but I might state this, and this we have straightened out only very, very recently. Now, A.P. Sinnett, when he wrote his incidents in the life of Madame Blavatsky, which were to be called memoirs of Madame Blavatsky until H.P.B. put her foot on that prospective title, these incidents contain quite a bit of text translated from the journal of HPB's sister Vera Dzhelikhovsky. Now this manuscript was in Russian. We do not know the actual whereabouts of the Russian manuscript. Perhaps it has been destroyed long ago. But the main point is that HPB herself translated a considerable amount from her sister's diary into English. And that was done for the benefit of Mr. Sinnett, who was then writing his book about HPB. HPB did all this sort of under protest, but nevertheless she did it. Now this translation into English of her sister's diary exists at Adyar, in the Adyar archives, in HPB's own handwriting. About one-third or possibly one-half of it has been used by Sinnett in his book, but the other half has never been published and contains some illuminating footnotes by HPB, which she appended to her sister's narrative. I have recently obtained, by permission from Brother Sri Ram, the complete microfilm of that manuscript, and as soon as I am through reading it and transcribing it, we probably will be able to publish some of the unpublished portions, either in the Theosophist or elsewhere.
Mr. Dzerkhov, could you trace from the very beginnings in her childhood the relations of Madame Blavatsky with the two masters whom she regarded as her mentors in the founding of the Theosophical Society?
In this relation, we had better keep just one of the teachers in mind. It was, of course, what we later understood to be the Master M, or Moria. He was the personal teacher of HPB as a disciple. The relation between that teacher and HPB for years was, of course, a very vague thing, indefinite. It was a matter of visions and general feelings and intuitions and so forth, and protective guidance, until 1851, which was the first time when HPB, then in London, met that individual in his physical body. Master M was part of the Nepal embassy in those days. He came, of course, under some other name and made himself known to HPB. They met in Hyde Park in London. That was their first meeting in the physical, we might say. She recognized him as having been the individual whom she had seen in early days in a psychic, psycho-spiritual manner. She met the same teacher physically again in 1854, also in England. But it was not until 1867, 68, more or less, that she actually penetrated into Tibet and cemented, we might say, her profound and abiding relations with the teachers. It is our understanding that she met Master K.H. much later, in other words, not before she went to Tibet. He did not seem to play any definite role in the early days. From the days, of course, of the founding of the Theosophical Society, or even 2-3 years before that, her relation to these teachers and to others was a matter of everyday occurrence. It was a progressive thing. The whole of her relation to the teachers was a progressive thing from childhood, more and more so, until she blossomed out into a regular and accepted and officially recognized messenger from the Lodge of the Brothers.
You mentioned that HPB met Master Moria in London again in 1854. Was he still with the Nepal embassy at that time?
No, but he was on another mission. One of the Hindu princes had been deposed, and he was being sent to London. And he was in some capacity connected with him. I do not have the details of this on my fingertips, but I have the whole data, as far as we know, in my files. And Mary Kay Neff has written some things about that second meeting. We will put all of this material together as soon as possible and really make either a record or a tape or a substantial article with all the evidence and references so that it would be preserved for posterity.
Then let's go back now to the fact, to the time when Madame Blavatsky left her home the second time in, I believe you said, 1864.
Well, after that, she went to Tibet. She was one of the first peoples to go through the Suez Canal somehow or other. And
which was opened what year?
I think it was 62, if I don't mistake. These were the years of her training. Our understanding is that she never stayed in Tibet very long. When the question arose as to whether she had been there for 7 years, she said, yes, 7 years altogether, but not right along. Her various visits were there at different times, probably mainly between 64 and 72, I would say. And she received her main and very severe training in Tibet in those days, before being ready for her work, for her official work in the forming of the Theosophical Society.
What external evidence, not related to the Society at all, do we have which would go to prove that Madame Blavatsky did go to Tibet sometime in the 1860s?
Very little indeed, except for the testimony of 2 or 3 people in India who met her in unusual places in the foothills of Tibet. We have very little, if any, exoteric evidence from non-theosophical sources.
I thought there was a British Army officer who said that he had traced the journey of a lone white woman into Tibet during those years and had come to the conclusion that it was Madame Blavatsky.
That is correct, and that has been substantiated by Alcott, who met that officer. He was Colonel Murray, general later.
Did Madame Blavatsky ever put into writing anywhere that you know of any descriptions of how she got into the bed or how she got out or how long she stayed there or under what conditions she lived there or under what conditions she found the masters living?
Practically nothing. I don't believe I could point out to any letter or article or anything in which she said anything worthwhile, anything of any moment, of any factual type regarding her stay in Tibet. Perhaps the only reference I know of is that she stated that she lived in the house of Master K.H.'s sister, and perhaps a passing reference to the effect that one of the teachers was taken care of, just like any other man, of his own house in the sense of keeping it clean and all that sort of thing. Just a passing reference to that. Perhaps also another passing reference to the effect that KH had some function to perform, a purely exoteric function in Lamaistic hierarchy. He was engaged in having some duties in regard to the administration at one of the monasteries, I think, in Tsigadze. Beyond that, I believe H.P.B. never said a single word about what she did in Tibet, exactly where she was, how she got in, how she went out, except perhaps for vague hints that she met someone who guided her to where the teachers were. I suppose the whole subject was under the pledge of strict secrecy as far as she was concerned, and just was not supposed to be talked about. We have no first-hand statement from her lips as to what she did in Tibet, not even the actual year when she was there.
What happened to Madame Blavatsky then after her last known visit to Tibet?
She came back to Europe sometime in 1871, and she is known to have been in Romania and in Greece and possibly in what is today Yugoslavia, and she made a very short trip across the border into Russia and says she did not stay there but a few days on some errand, after which I think her last stay in Europe in those days was Greece. She embarked in July on a steamer and apparently bound for Alexandria in Egypt. The boiler exploded on that steamer. Everybody was catapulted into the sea and most of them were drowned. She was saved and taken over with no belongings of any kind to Alexandria and hence to Cairo. And it is during that trip when she landed in Egypt that she was helped by a woman who later, when she married, became Madame Emma Coulon, a very unsavory fame in the history of the Theosophical Society. H.P.B. remained very grateful to her for being helped in those days. She stayed in Cairo perhaps 6 months, more or less, and she started a little society for the investigation of spiritualistic and occult phenomena by reliable mediums. But this came to naught. It was some kind of an effort along occult lines, but it had no success whatsoever. She ran into all kinds of frauds and had to disband the whole thing. From there she moved to Paris. Madame Coulon disappeared from the stage of her of HPB's life for the time being. It was just a casual meeting, apparently. that some kind of a karmic connection existed there. In 1872, HBB lived with one of her cousins in Paris, and apparently, from what she says, had no idea of going to the United States. But she received a peremptory order in 1873 from her teacher to move on to New York, and did so. That was her the beginning, I would say, of her great mission. She came to the United States on July the 7th, 1873.
Just a minute. Could I ask in there something about the manner of her passage? Now, one of the very unhappily critical books written about Madame Blavatsky states that she came by steerage, but it seems to me there was more to it than that. Do you know that story?
Yes, there was more to it. She found, before embarking on this steamer, we don't know what steamer it was, but apparently she embarked from Cherbourg in France. She found some woman with children, as far as I remember, who had either lost her tickets altogether, or somebody had stolen them away from her.
I believe somebody, a ticket scalper, had sold her a worthless steamship passage.
Something like that. HBB, of course, was holding a ticket, holding her passage.
First class.
First class, and she exchanged it for steerage so that both of them could go. This was one of those self-sacrificing moves on her part. She seems to have traveled with another couple, friends, I think, from France, but their names are mentioned only in one obscure letter of HPB, and nothing more is known about them. But when she arrived to New York, that was the beginning of her real mission. However, between July 1873 and, let us say, the middle of 1874, or even the end of 1874, when she began to write her first articles in the spiritualistic press, we have quite a little time, quite a little period there to account for. And for a good many years, nobody knew what HPV was doing in the United States for almost a year and a half of complete silence. Well, some letters were found not so long ago, addressed to her great friend in Russia, which have thrown some light upon this situation.
Do you remember the name of this friend?
Prince Dundukov Karsakov, an old friend of the family, much older than she was. He was viceroy in the Caucasus. It appears that HPV again crossed the United States to San Francisco, took a steamer to Yokohama, Japan, where Master M was staying for the time being, spent there about 1 week, and returned in the same fashion. Now you can readily imagine that in those days, in 1873 and 4, such a journey took quite some little time, which would account for at least a number of months of this interim period. What she did in Yokohama, nobody knows. But that's what she had to go through by order again. Now, at the end of 1874 and in 1875, began this whole episode of meeting Colonel Olcott at the farmhouse of the Eddy brothers in Vermont, at Chittenden, Vermont, and the gradual initiation, we might say, of the Colonel into the mysteries of true occultism, and finally the founding of the Theosophical Society, which of course are all subject fully treated by the Colonel himself in the old diary leaves.
There has been a tendency on some, on the part of some critics of the society or of the Adyar Society to neglect Colonel Alcott's place in the founding of the society or belittle its importance. How do you feel about this?
Well, Mr. Gardner, with regard to feelings that exist in some parts of the Theosophical movement against the Colonel, with regard to this feeling, I have very definite ideas. I will frankly say that every time Colonel Alcott is minimized or ignored, this makes me sore. I'm not speaking now from the standpoint of a personal feeling, but rather from the standpoint of history. It is unjust and it is non-factual. The Colonel played in the history of the Theosophical movement in the early days a role practically equal to the role played by HPB, but their roles were different. The Colonel was the exoteric organizer, and HPB was the occultist and the messenger from the Brotherhood. Colonel Alcott was a personal disciple of Master M, but he was a beginner for quite a number of years and gradually rose in stature. HPB, on the other hand, was the occultist from former incarnations, and their roles, of course, were completely different. But had there been no Colonel Alcott around, there would have been no Theosophical Society as an organization. Just as much as if there had been no HPB, the masters would have had to find somebody else or to postpone the whole experiment perhaps another 100 years. We must be fair in these matters. Colonel Alcott had his weaknesses and shortcomings, and so had HPB. I'd like to find somebody who has no shortcomings. I believe that the masters themselves have their own shortcomings. They are not infallible and never made any claims to being perfect. So why are we always trying to find the weaknesses and shortcomings of the people instead of emphasizing the magnificent work that some of them have done? I'd like to find another individual in the entire history of the Theosophical Society since 1875 to the present moment who has done such an enormous work in the cause of the masters as Colonel Alcott has. To disregard him, to ignore him, to minimize what he has done shows simply the smallness, the puny character of the individuals who are doing this. To speak of him in terms of laudation and glorification, such as no human being deserves, is wrong also. It is just a one-sided approach, either on one side or another. We must be fair, I repeat. Colonel Alcott made mistakes. We know some of these mistakes, but we do not fully know the reason for such mistakes. He too was an individual on tests with his own trials and tribulations. He could by no means escape making mistakes. But the attitude that has existed and exists today in some of the sections of the Theosophical movement to put him completely into the background is an attitude which is non-factual, it is not good history, and it does not reflect upon the fairness of the individuals who are engaged in it.
The writing of Isis Unveiled then began after the formation of the Theosophical Society, is that right?
Yes, approximately so. I think it coincided with it more or less. She began to write Isis Unveiled somewhere in 1874 or the beginning of 75. It was published in 1877. Isis Unveiled as a piece of writing, of course, can be considered together with the Secret Doctrine, although the Secret Doctrine was written much later and it took quite a number of years to be completed. But both works can be looked upon from the same standpoint if we look upon them as the production or the unusual production of a literary type, in that H.P.B. quoted in both of them from a tremendous number of various books, pamphlets, magazines, newspapers, and journals without ever having had any access to them. The only explanation, and of course she gives such an explanation herself in more than one place, is that the facts contained in these books that she quoted from, the passages required, were read by her in the astral light. She says that a great many of them she could read herself or summon herself before her vision. But a great many other ones she had to have the help of her teacher with. In other words, there were limitations to her spiritual vision in the Akasha. She had, of course, a great deal of help from the teachers, as well as a considerable amount of help on purely exoteric lines from some of the members who supplied a good many of the quotations. But this was the least part of the thing, the least part of the story. Had H.P.B. been unable to consult books astrally, she could have never written within such a short time either The Secret Doctrine or Isis Unveiled. Isis Unveiled became a bestseller almost overnight. I believe that they printed something like 1,000 copies in the first impression, and they were sold within a few weeks. So, you see, there was an astounding work that made a tremendous impact. If anybody reprints Isis Unveiled now in a new edition, it sells out very rapidly. It is still a bestseller in some parts of the world and with some type of people.
What was the reason the founders decided to move their headquarters from New York City to India?
As a matter of fact, they didn't move their headquarters to India exactly. The Theosophical Society founded in New York remained in New York for a while and sent H.P.B. and Alcott as delegates to India. And it is only later that their stay in India became more or less permanent, and the Theosophical Society in New York ceased to be what we might say the center. It was still called the parent body for quite some time and was issuing diploma, but at a later date, provided by the Constitution, the headquarters was to be at the place where the founders were. That's the manner in which the headquarters, or the main seat of the society anyway, became India. That was long before Adyar was founded. Now, you might say this, and that is that the move to India, as well as the later move of H.P.B. to London, are really not sudden things that have no relation with each other. It looks, from a careful observation of that history, that the Theosophical movement had to organize nuclei of force, of occult force, in America, in India, and in Europe. And that the presence of this great messenger, which H.P.B. was inwardly, the inner H.P.B. we might say, her presence was necessary first in America, then in India, and then in a later part of her life in London. There was a pattern to that, I'm convinced.
What external evidence from fairly reliable witnesses has come down to us concerning phenomenal events that occurred in the life of Madame Blavatsky?
The evidence is considerable. We are by no means limited to the writings of Colonel Alcott. We have a quite a large number of various accounts by eyewitnesses, members in India, members in the United States, and members all over Europe. We have long accounts from William Quan Judge, her great collaborator and one of the three chief co-founders of the Theosophical Society in America. The accounts of these eyewitnesses are very frequent, or were very frequent in those days. They have written about it, they have written articles in newspapers and magazines of the day, they have left some of their memoirs, so that we are by no means limited to just a few, a handful of people who have testified about them. The strange powers which HPB had, as any occultist would have been publicized, we might say, even a little bit too much. And where they have been publicized too much, not enough attention has been paid to the philosophy back of them.
Would you be able to give a brief statement of some of the types of phenomena or powers displayed by HPB on various occasions?
Well, it was mainly along the line of psychic and spiritual vision of events and occurrences, as well as the character of the people, the reading of sealed letters, the instantaneous transference of her consciousness to different parts of the world, and perhaps more than anything else, the materialization or physical production of objects and bits of writing on paper, or the materialization of the paper and the writing on them on various occasions. As well as the production of music out of what we might call nothing, just out of sheer air. Probably the most startling phenomena were phenomena of materialization. It would take a long time to explain them, of course, and probably we wouldn't be able to explain them too well anyway. But the records about these types of phenomena, which she produced, these records are very widespread, but she always spoke of them as merely samples of the powers innate in man. However, we can never emphasize too much the fact that HPB was the messenger from the great teachers who was sent to provide at this cyclic and critical time the foundation principles of a great philosophy of life, to instill into the minds of men the rudiments of true esoteric knowledge. Phenomena are phenomena, and they are good in their place. But what the world needs and what the world has received through her works are the foundation principles, the great precepts of the esoteric philosophy of all ages, which is the only basis upon which a new civilization can arise.